Hello, this is Bare Naked Politics. This is the best podcast in the world for understanding what's going on in the news. So I just strip it all back, I make it simple, I make it easy to follow. So there's no requirement for you to be any kind of expert in order to keep up. It's not necessary. You don't need to have watched the news in a month and you will still get what I'm on about. The world is full of politics experts. They're crawling all over my Facebook feed. But here, everyone's invited to the conversation. I'm Julia Bell, and the big story that we're going to talk about today is this row between the EU and the UK. Bearing in mind that we've only actually been fully out of the EU for a month, 1 month. I know that technically we left in February 2020, but we entered this Brexit transition period for 11 months. And that was where, yes, we were out, but all the old rules pretty much still applied. So it kind of felt like we were still members. So in terms of fully being out in the cold, it's only been a month and already things have gotten a bit grisly. And it's all about vaccines. It's all about the distribution of them and who can get access to more than who. And that's what it's about. So we'll cover that off. We'll make sure you're really comfortable with it. And actually, I got Alex Morgan, who is a ridiculously talented broadcast journalist. He focuses on all things EU. You've heard him on this podcast before. I got him back to unravel it all with me because it's a massive topic. So it's kind of a two-man job. So you'll hear that soon. And actually, before I get onto that, I just want to take a few minutes to talk about the different vaccines. That's been a big question from you lot on social media is what they all are and how they differ. Because now that we're seeing them be rolled out across, it's over 8 million people in the UK now have had one dose of the vaccine at least. People are starting to think, oh my God, it might be my turn soon. I'd love to know a bit about them. So we'll do that. And I think once you've got your head around that, it will make it easier to follow the rest of the sort of vaccine-related news. And like I say, the things that I cover in this podcast and the questions that I answer are all driven by you. So if you want to ask something or if you want to suggest an idea for a future episode, the only way to do it is to follow me on Instagram and Twitter. The handle's the same, @JuliaBell_X. And I implore you to slide into my DMs. Go for it. So let's talk about these vaccines. Okay, heavy questioning this week about the different vaccines. I understand it because we went from having nothing to having this buffet of different jabs. And I think it might be nice to just talk you through those, at least the ones that we're rolling out here in the UK. So the first one that was approved by the UK regulators, the first of three that we've got so far, was the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. That was approved on the 2nd of December 2020. I feel like it was yesterday. I remember it like it was yesterday because it was like this beacon of light amidst the steady stream of shit that 2020 had been pumping relentlessly into our lives. And if I'm not mistaken, the UK was the first country in the world to approve it. I'm just going to double check that because I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, it was the first country in the world to approve it. So that was a big day on many levels. And the instruction leaflet, if you will, on that vaccine says that it's meant to come in two doses, which are 3 weeks apart-ish. Although you'll have seen that the UK government have opted against that. And instead, they've decided, let's just give out one dose to as many people as we possibly can. And then we'll revisit them and give them a second dose later down the line. But better to give one dose to as many people as possible so they've got some degree of immunity, even if they've not got the full thing. Rather that than have just some people with immunity and then a huge swathe of people that have got nothing. So that's the mentality. That's a debate in itself that we can talk about another time if you like. But fundamentally, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine says that it's meant to come in two doses, 3 weeks apart. And if you do that, it's got a 95% effectiveness rate. One kind of weird thing about the Pfizer jab is that you have to store it at minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is so cold that I can't even imagine it. It's just unthinkably cold, and that means it's dead hard to store and it's really hard to transport because normal freezers don't go down that low. So getting it across the world and then keeping it and storing it in hospitals and GP practices and stuff has proven a bit of a logistical challenge. And then prices, we've got to talk about the prices. So the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is thought to be £15 per dose. So £30 technically for the full two dose experience. And that's a lot of cash. If you think about how many millions of people are getting jabs at the moment in the UK, and perhaps there are deals struck on these things and perhaps there's different prices, but ballpark, that's what we know is that it's £15 per dose. So is a lot of money in real terms. Anyway, then, a matter of weeks later, the 30th of December 2020, the news came out that we had another one that had been approved. This time, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine had been approved by the UK. And this is the jab that the politicians and the press were calling the UK's success story. Because, of course, the research for this one happened at Oxford University on our turf. And I know this thing isn't about, you know, an international competition. That's not what this is. It was still a moment of national pride to sort of have the UK be seen on the international stage as one of the sort of spearheads in this movement to combat the virus. So that definitely was a moment. And this one's also interesting because it's dead cheap, much cheaper in comparison to the other two. The received knowledge is that it's priced about £3 per dose. It's also a two-dose vaccine, so £6 per person if you think about it that way. And they're meant to be given to you between 4 and 12 weeks apart. So £3 per dose, it's cheap as chips, isn't it, comparatively? Which is another triumph because even though we as the people aren't paying for these at all, doesn't matter what vaccine you get, you're not going to have to pay for it, it is still coming out of the government's ever depleting pot of money. So if they can get a cheaper one, then they're winning. That's going to be much more appealing to them. Also on storage, much more straightforward. You can just store the Oxford ones in a fridge, like the fridge that you get in your house. So yeah, if you're looking to set up like a black market vaccine station, then the Oxford vaccine is your best bet because it needs to be stored between, is it -3 and -8 or 3 and 8? Let me check. Oh, yeah. So it only needs to be stored between 3 and 8 degrees, because, of course, I guess anything lower than zero and it would be like freezer temperature. So there you go. Really, really easy to store that one. Although the effectiveness rate appears to be slightly lower. So we're looking at 62 to 90% effective, somewhere in that zone. It seems like a really big zone, but that's the figure. And that has had quite a few people saying, oh, I don't want that one then because it doesn't work as well. But from the trials, absolutely nobody got seriously ill or had to go to hospital because of COVID. So from that theory, if you have this vaccine and you get COVID, it's not going to be a dire situation. Otherwise, it just wouldn't have gotten approved, if that makes sense. So that vaccine does work, but that kind of explains that effectiveness thing. And then the third one that's been approved here in the UK was the Moderna vaccine. And that was dead soon after the Oxford one. That was on the 8th of January. So all three of them were approved within a month and a week of each other. Moderna's an American company, so they were a key player in this race as well, and that was like a big moment for them. And we have pre-ordered millions of those, but I believe we've not rolled them out yet. So that's going to come, I think, closer to springtime. Details on that one, it's meant to be 94% effective, so just under the Pfizer one. It's also a two-dose vaccine. You're meant to get one and then wait at least 28 days and then get the other one. Price-wise, oh my God, it's £25 per dose, apparently. So she's pricey, she's classy, she's sassy. What? I'm sorry, it's been such a long lockdown and I'm on my own at the moment. I am losing my mind. Storage-wise, -20. So not as easy as Oxford, but much easier than Pfizer. And that's a wrap. Those are the vaccines that have been approved so far. Although there's loads more in the works. It will not just be those three that we're dealing with. And the UK government have pre-ordered vaccines from the likes of GlaxoSmithKline and Novavax before they've been approved. So the regulators haven't even decided that, you know, they're good yet. And the government have still got their name on that list because the general sentiment is that they will eventually be approved. And the government wants to be front of the queue. It's like, do you know what it's like? It's like buying an Hermes Birkin. You've got to get your name on the list and you've got to pay for the thing before it's even been made, let alone given to you. So that's what the jabs are like. They're like Hermes Birkins. If you don't know what I'm talking about, Hermes Birkins are handbags, and if you don't care about handbags, maybe don't Google them because you'll see the price and that will make you confused and angry and upset. So there's that. Lots of you asked me to do that little run through, slightly dry, but at least you've got the information in your brain now and you've got this podcast for your reference. Although undoubtedly, as soon as I upload this podcast, a new one will be approved and this podcast will be out of date. But hopefully that should still be useful because literally as you're listening to me, people are getting the Pfizer and the Oxford, at least, in their arms right now. So it's good to be on top of. And as it stands, I'm recording this very late in the evening on Sunday, the 31st of January, more than 8 million doses have been administered between the Pfizer and the Oxford jabs. And if you think about the fact that the Pfizer was the first one that was approved on the 2nd of December, and we're only now just at the end of, well, by the time you're listening to this, the beginning of February, and we've already done 8 million. That is super, super speed from researching it to approving it to getting it in people's arms. We're breaking records all over the place. But in this climate, even when there is objective success, like with the speed of this vaccine rollout, you're always going to come up against something. And there's always going to be some sort of political clusterfuck. And in this instance, it was the EU that popped its head over the laurel bush right on cue and surprised us with a right hook to the jaw. And this is quite the row, because the EU have been watching these vaccines pour into the UK, and they've not quite had the same speed of distribution. And that has led to leaders within the European Union getting desperate, or within the European Commission, I should say. And that's gotten kind of ugly over the past week, and it's had a big ripple effect over loads of different things. So to help talk me through what exactly happened and what this row is about and what all the consequences are, I jumped on FaceTime with my buddy Alex, Alex Morgan, who is the ultimate European politics geek that we all need in our lives. Just to warn you, though, this topic, it covers so many things. It covers COVID, Brexit, the border in Ireland. It's a lot. We did go at an easy pace and we explained absolutely everything, but it's dense. Just so you know, the next 25 minutes of your life, it's going to be a lot. If you need to go make a coffee, do it now, I would say. But yeah, you are about to have this very huge topic completely cleared up. So this is what we said. Hello.
Hello, Julia. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, we only ever seem to speak when there's some sort of massive European crisis.
I know. I'm sorry. We can talk about something else at some point soon, I promise. But speaking of EU crises, can we just talk about this one really quick?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, okay. Because the EU and the UK have fallen out yet again. But this time it's over vaccine distribution. What's happened? Can you start from the beginning?
Start from the beginning. So basically, as soon as it became clear that the coronavirus, COVID-19, is going to change all of our lives, you know, the end point of this was always going to be a vaccine.
Yeah.
So a lot of leaders were like, right, the first thing we need to do is make sure a vaccine is in development and that we get our hands on it as soon as it comes out. And so, of course, the whole world wanted the same thing. What's really interesting about the EU, of course, is the EU is 27 countries.
Yeah.
And health is normally an issue that the countries themselves deal with. But on this one, the EU had decided that they would deal with the purchasing of vaccines together. So that would be dealt with in Brussels by the European Commission, which is the kind of civil service of the EU. And so all the countries, big and small, would work together at this higher level, handing this power over to Brussels to coordinate and make sure they get the vaccines in. Now, for smaller countries like, you know, for example, Malta, Luxembourg, you can imagine that was a great comfort because they weren't suddenly going to be feeling like they were going to be outbid or last of the queue because of their size. They were part of this big European picture. However, the issue has come because the UK didn't join that scheme. The UK did not want to use that transition period, Brexit transition period, to be kind of in on this EU scheme. They said, no, thanks. We're going to look to buy our own vaccines. We're going to sort our own deals.
So this was arranged when we were still technically half in the EU.
Yes. And we could have been a part of this EU purchasing scheme.
But I'm not surprised Boris Johnson said, not interested.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, a lot of it was coming from Matt Hancock. And we'll come back to old Hancock in a second. But basically, Julia, I'm sure you remember, I'm sure people remember, loads of people saying, oh, the UK is going to be in a real mess. They're not part of this EU purchasing scheme. How are they going to keep up? Brexit Britain is going to be on its own. What's actually turned out that has happened is the scheme in the UK, you know, headed up by Matt Hancock and others, has worked. And the EU scheme has been beset by delays. a lack of seemingly joined up thinking. The countries of Europe are very, very angry at the European Commission in Brussels for basically seemingly doing deals that are too slow, that don't guarantee quick supply, enough supply. At the same time, of course, the UK, who approved the vaccines earlier, signed the deals to access them earlier. Well, they're getting these drugs delivered, they're getting them in people's arms, and the UK has now got over 8 million people vaccinated. So the EU, if you like, the countries of Europe, very angry that their joined-up approach has effectively got off to such a bad start.
But why does this lead to the EU falling out with the UK? Surely the EU recognised that we said no to their joint scheme. But why has the EU got a problem with that? Where's the dispute coming from?
So the really interesting thing about this is the stuff we're talking about here is normally done. Approving a vaccine is normally done over a period of 10 years. This vaccine, we went from the first cases in Europe to a vaccine in about 10 months. I mean, it's extraordinary. And in order to get the vaccine approved, countries have effectively used emergency powers, basically saying to companies, look, we're going to make exceptions on this one. You're allowed to produce these drugs and distribute them across the population in a way that we normally would not consider a sort of safe time frame. We'd want much longer tests, much slower process. This was an emergency. Now, the really interesting thing is the UK was able to rely on its own regulator, yes, but the kind of emergency powers that they were, you know, this kind of emergency approval actually was coming from laws that they had been part of as part of the EU. So the really funny thing here is, Julia, is that actually the UK did take advantage of the Brexit transition period, as in the medicines regulator here did say, okay, we're going to use this EU law saying we can emergency, you know, we can have an emergency approval of vaccines. But the big difference is the UK effectively used that law to domestically approve the vaccines, whereas the EU was doing it all at a higher level together. And the European medicine regulator, for whatever reason, just happened to be slower. Same conclusion, vaccines are safe, these vaccines are good. They just took a much longer time to get there. And we're saying much longer, I mean, 3 weeks. In the history of vaccines, that is a blink of an eye.
But that's hundreds of thousands of people difference.
Yes, it is. Well, now we're talking millions. So where's the EU annoyed? So with that little bit of context there, it was very much the case that the EU was coming to these drug makers after the UK had. So these drug makers have already signed deals with the UK. They've already started supplying the UK. And then the EU is coming along. So one of these drug makers in particular, called AstraZeneca, that is a British European company, who don't really have a background in making vaccines. That's the really interesting thing. They don't really have a background in making vaccines, but hey, 2020, 21, you know.
Everyone's adapting. Yeah.
Everyone's adapting. They basically, you know, if you like, the UK chose them to supply the Oxford vaccine because they saw it as a safer option that would guarantee the UK gets the doses. And we know the Oxford vaccine is one of those ones that's much cheaper and easier to distribute. So AstraZeneca, this private company, along come the EU and say, we also want access to this drug. Civi play. AstraZeneca say to them, okay, we'll do our best to meet the commitments we signed up to, but we probably can't guarantee you all the doses right away. And the EU basically said to that, whoa, that's not good enough, excuse me. If you're going to be making any element of this vaccine in the European Union and then shipping it off to global customers, the UK or wherever, that's not on. We want the drugs you promised us. And so this is the origin of the row. It was really about the EU and a particular drug manufacturer. And that's where the tension came.
So basically, the EU are in a tight spot because they weren't off the mark as quick as the UK was. The UK got in quick, ordered a bunch of vaccines. They're already in the UK and lots of them are still incoming. And the EU's gone, well, hang on, AstraZeneca has a big factory in the Netherlands. It has a big factory in Belgium. They're EU nations. So why don't we just go to AstraZeneca and say, you can't send your vaccines to any other countries, including the UK, until you can show us that you've met our demands first. That's what the EU have done, isn't it?
I think where the real tension comes is, as I was saying at the beginning, the whole world wants the same thing. There are literally only so many needles and glass jars in the world. there's only so much vaccine you can produce. Of course, this is all being stepped up, but still, it was a case of how do you get the supply to everyone in a way that's never been done before? And the EU felt that companies like, for example, AstraZeneca, were effectively honouring contracts to the UK and others ahead of their obligations to Europe. But fundamentally, it's all about this fear of vaccine nationalism. What is to stop countries going, if it's made here, we're having it? But that's not how pharmaceuticals work. Drugs developed in Oxford can be manufactured and distributed in Europe and then brought back into the UK. You know what I mean? This is the nature of pharmaceuticals. It doesn't have the borders of, say, national states. So therefore, the fear was if countries start drawing their borders, you're going to cut the vaccine supply, particularly to the poorer nations, and you're going to get yourself into a vaccine war, maybe even a bidding war. And then it really went too far when they said, we're going to stop you exporting it from the EU to the UK through the island of Ireland.
Yeah, so here you're talking about the EU threatening to physically block vaccines from crossing the border from the Republic of Ireland, which is an EU member state, into Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, since that is the only land border between the EU and the UK. And I mean, on the one hand, it's a very abrupt solution to the EU's problem because it just physically blocks them from losing vaccines to us. But this is territory that gets dangerous, especially when you're talking about that border on the island of Ireland, because it has got a very recent history of violence and unrest, right? That border is a delicate place, especially to start talking about putting checkpoints on, because that could easily bring back memories of checkpoints that were there during the Troubles a few decades ago, which were hubs of violence and unrest. And the ironic thing is, we thought that Brexit would be the biggest threat to that border. And we thought, oh my God, because of Brexit, we're going to see checkpoints, we're going to see barriers, we're going to see walls being put in place along that line to check goods coming in and out of the countries and to, you know, check people's passports and stuff like that. But we managed to get through Brexit without falling down at that. You know, we managed to get through Brexit. We put in place the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is part of the Brexit agreement. And that is what stops a hard border at all costs. So 4 years of Brexit negotiations and we managed to swerve this border problem. And then the EU turns around during the pandemic and say, actually, maybe we should just start checking things and blocking things at that border because you guys in the UK, you're nicking too many vaccines and we're worried that Northern Ireland is proving to be a bit of a backdoor. You know, no wonder people have been kicking off at the EU for that.
They spent, Jean-Claude Juncker and then Ursula von der Leyen, years lecturing the UK on the importance of keeping peace in Ireland and having no border. People saying Brexit's the stupidest idea because it threatens all this. The UK basically whipped from all angles. And then in the course of a single day, the EU seemed to completely, at the higher level that is, seemed to completely give up on all of that moral chat and go, you know what, actually it's fine. They'd shown themselves to not care about the key issue. Ireland wasn't even notified, Julia. They didn't even talk to Ireland.
Yeah, they were blindsided. They were blindsided, the very leaders who it would have affected the most, the Irish leaders. They would have been the ones that would be tasked with trying to keep the peace if the checkpoints started popping up at that border to stop vaccines getting into the UK. It would be the Irish leaders that would be left with that. And it would be one hell of a political move that they would be making, because during the Brexit negotiations, just so everyone's clear on this, they put a clause in that Northern Ireland Protocol, which is the section of Brexit which prevents a hard border from popping up. But they put a clause in it called Article 16, which allows either side, the UK or the EU, to abandon the Northern Ireland Protocol in an emergency. So in like special circumstances. So if something poses an economic threat or a societal problem or whatever, then either side is entitled to invoke Article 16 and potentially look to having checkpoints popping up at that border. But it is a fucking nuclear option. And you're meant to do it with all parties at least aware of the fact that you're thinking about doing it. It's not something that you can just blindside everyone with, like you say. So the way that the EU threatened to go about this was, it was kind of all wrong, wasn't it? But have they backtracked on that officially now and said, actually, oh God, that was a mistake? Or are they still insisting that invoking Article 16 is an option if they keep on missing out on vaccines?
Really good question. And I think that's a question a lot of people are asking. The EU, Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission, by making that decision and then backtracking on Friday, have done themselves so much damage. I mean, they had a shocking week. But the EU hasn't completely backtracked. The Commission have said, okay, yeah, whoops. Oh, we're actually not going to invoke Article 16. That was a bit hasty. But we're going to reserve the right to do so in the future, maybe. Possibly. I don't know. Maybe.
So it is still on the table.
It is. Now, I do not think for a second they will get away with it, because they've managed to unite Ireland, that's the Republicans, Northern Ireland, that's the Unionists, the UK, the Brexiteers, the Remainers in the UK.
Yeah.
Everybody on the same side saying, whoa, 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 excuse me, what are you doing? This is stupidly dangerous. Why are you doing it? They managed to unite all of these different sides. And I think if you're going to do that, that's a stupid policy that even the European Commission, I think, would think is too risky, even if it gave them a short-term advantage in grabbing vaccine supply.
So what is the European Commission's solution then? Because like you say, they ultimately have a shortage of vaccines. They've got 27 member states, all of whom don't have enough of these vaccines. What are they going to do about that while the UK is enjoying them all rolling in nice and smoothly?
Well, there's a lot of suggestions and questions about whether this massive early peak for the UK continues. Does the UK keep going up, 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 or does there come a point where things level off because of supply or, you know, the nature of the global supply chain, these kind of things. At the same time, the EU will get itself going. I mean, the European Union, we're talking about 27 of the most advanced nations in the world, countries, France, Germany. I mean, these are powerhouse countries. They will push forward. They will get there. What I think we've seen is a short-term shortage, which has come from the fact the EU is just later to signing the deals, later to actually approving the vaccines, and therefore countries like the UK, Israel, others who are already signed up probably have, you know, they were being supplied at a time when the EU obviously wants in. The companies themselves can go, we can only do so much. These countries got here first. We're going to do them first. But now you're here. I think what you'll see is over the next month or so, supply starting to even out, to trickle through. There is a real question though, Julia, real question, I believe, which is with the WHO warning that countries that are leading should kind of pause and give some vaccines to other countries. And not just, for example, the UK to the EU, but maybe the UK and the EU to the developing world. You know, at what point do we go, okay, we vaccinated all the 80-year-olds, 70-year-olds, rather than doing like our age group, for example, those vaccines should go over to help other countries. There's a real fear, I think, that's still there about the richer nations grabbing it. Never mind this dispute between rich nations. What about the bigger issue, which is the dispute between rich nations and the developing world and countries grabbing it all for themselves? It's an uncertain time. Do you know what? Being honest with you, Julia, I don't think it's going to be the doomsday scenario everyone thinks. I think that the fact we have a vaccine, for me anyway, personal opinion here, I really do think that this will be a triumph for pharmaceuticals and also global cooperation. I do think the vaccines will. I don't think there'll be a vaccine war.
You're more optimistic than me when you say, you know, I think I foresee global cooperation. I don't. The UK have set the tone by ordering shit tons and not even thinking about other nations. I mean, as recently as today, Matt Hancock has said, I'm sorry, it's too soon for us to start thinking about donating vaccines. We're just looking after ourselves. And when asked about this whole dispute, the European Commission statement was, and this is a quote, the protection and safety of our citizens is a priority, and the challenges we now face have left us no choice but to act. These are, and that's them defending this whole dispute about potentially blocking vaccines from being exported elsewhere. So these richer nations, like you say, are setting the tone, and they're saying, You developing nations aren't the ones that are going to be voting us in. Our own people are going to be the ones that are re-electing us. So they're the ones that we're interested in, to be honest. And if we can get them all vaccinated, that's priority one. And then poor people in other countries will think about you later on. That seems to be, from where I stand, how most of the developed nations are thinking, at least so far.
I think that's right. I think for me, the idea is, do you remember last year when nurses around the world were wearing bin bags because they didn't have PPE? And there was a global shortage and a global scramble for PPE. And countries like Germany and others said, anything made in this country, we're not exporting it. No, no, it's staying. And now, of course, the supply has risen because, of course, the demand shot up and the supply couldn't keep up. Now it can. You're not seeing those same nationalistic tendencies about it. I believe that the whole world is going to be in vaccine production overdrive. And the kind of short-term thing we're seeing now and the kind of arguments, I think will probably be the 2021 arguments. But I would like to think, I would hope by 2022, the kind of vaccine nationalism kind of threat will kind of be seen now as we look at the PPE nationalism threat, something that came from an acute shortage, but hopefully will level out as the supply increases. I hope.
Me too. I hope you're right. But I just, yeah. It's interesting because we perceive that the government here and the EU Commission have fought quite hard to keep the relationship cordial between the UK and the EU. You know, Brexit was a nightmare. They fell out constantly. But now that we're out, officially, no transition period, nothing, we are out. It seems that both sides are hoping that everything's going to be okay. And it's only been a month. We've been out of the EU a month and we've already fallen out massively. We're talking nuclear, the EU threatening to potentially have a border built up in Ireland without even consulting Ireland. That is nuclear and that's after a month. Are you kind of concerned about the future of the relationship between the EU and the UK moving forward?
My fear doesn't come from Brexiteers. The thing is, what if the UK starts doing well? What if the UK is kind of fine outside of the European Union?
Alex, like, we're facing quite a lot of trouble at the moment.
We are, but you know, imagine we're fine, or imagine, for example, the UK is able to join with the United States and others in this sort of Pacific trade area. All very big questions at the moment. What if we start doing well? That's not good for the EU. That ultimately, for the politics side of it, for many nations in the European Union, that's not good. They'd love to see, I believe, there are some hardline Europhiles who would love to see the UK fall flat on its face.
Of course, because if we do well and we do better than we were when we were members, and we're free to make all these amazing trade deals that end up making our economy one of the envies of the world, then you're going to get the likes of Frexiteers in France and Italexiteers in Italy and so on going, oh, You were fine. We should do the same thing. And suddenly the EU crumbles. So, of course, they're interested in us screwing it up.
Exactly. And the EU has, you know, again, you see these tensions. The European Union wants to expand. It wants to expand to take in Albania and North Macedonia, right? It wants these member states. Emmanuel Macron of France said no, vetoed these expansion plans to much anger in the European Commission. Now, a project that wants to expand doesn't want to lose members. It doesn't look good if you start losing members. It doesn't look good if one of your members leaves and does really, really well. So my fear for the future of the relationship is, are the two sides, for example, the UK on the other side doesn't want to be seen to fall flat on its face, so will probably be quite hostile and quite, you know, bully boy-ish on the world stage. Are these two sides, who really should be the best of friends, irrespective of whether they are in a political union or not, we are allies on everything.
Yes.
You know, are these two sides going to be locked into some sort of stupid, effectively dick-measuring competition for the next decade? But I mean, it comes down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is that where the relationship's going? Because ultimately, we live in a world where the weather is going to be set by China. The whole world is going to be set. The direction we're all going in, it's the dragon has woken. We have fed it, and we have fed the system. You know, let's face it, greed in the West has led to a huge boom in China. All our products are made over there. Now China's standing up and starting to go, you know what, we're going to pursue our own interests. You know, this is the future. Ultimately, arguments and divisions between France and the UK, UK and Germany, it's not in any side's best interests. And I'm really worried that the kind of internal politics there might do what a lot of people perhaps hope they would do, tear countries and unions apart while other countries elsewhere in the world grow in strength, solidify their position, and then we all find ourselves in Europe, the continent that is, looking on at a world where we have, once again, a huge superpower, probably rivaling America, this time not the USSR, but China. And we all start going, oh, crumbs. What are we wasting all that time and money for?
Yeah, we should have all united instead of tearing each other apart. But EU and the European Commission have more worries than just the UK doing well and making them look bad. They're making themselves look bad, right? Because, like you say, they were slow off the mark getting these vaccines approved and distributed. They were slow ordering. They didn't order enough from the various pharmaceutical companies. And now they're making these political moves which make them look kind of cruel. So surely people within the EU member states, if I was a French person, or if I was, you know, a Name another EU country. If I was a Portuguese person looking at what the European Commission were doing, I'd be like, for God's sake, I have very little to do with you. You're all the way in Brussels and I'm over here in Portugal, and yet you're slowing me down from getting a jab in my arm. Surely everyone's looking at the European Commission going, you guys are a problem. I want my government to decide when I get a jab, not you guys.
Yeah. And a recent poll had Marine Le Pen in France, your favourite country of the European Union. It's your go-to, Julia. When it comes to France, Marine Le Pen, she is, we have never had certainly never had a female leader like that. We have never had a politician that right-wing ever stand a chance of becoming prime minister in this country. Over there, she is the head of the party, which is now called the Rassemblement National. It was previously called the National Front, and its roots were in a neo-fascist party started by her father.
Oh my God.
Hardcore right wing. Now, she nearly beat Macron last time round, and there was a real chance she could be the next president of France. Now, she's no friend of the EU. She doesn't want the chaos of Frexit. I personally don't believe she'd want that chaos, but her supporters certainly would like to hear her talk about it. So if the nationalist tendencies in countries like France grow and are fueled and fed by a dislike of how the EU's handled the coronavirus situation, I think we could see some, as you were describing, some real tensions in these countries and the rise of kind of right-wing populist leaders to the highest levels of a country even like France.
But it's not even right-wing, you know, populist policy that I think will be a route to other countries potentially splitting away. It's Brexit happened without coronavirus. It happened because we wanted more autonomy and, you know, right or wrong, people thought the EU had too much power over what we did internally. Now that the EU have cocked up the vaccine process, like you say, it's only a 3 or 4 week difference between what the EU have managed to do and what we've done, but that means millions of people's worth of difference. That is much stronger an argument for splitting away from a collective than what we had in the UK, and we didn't even need it to get enough people to vote. So surely, if I was Marine Le Pen, I would be saying, these guys cocked up the vaccine thing. Let's get out. Or let's put them under pressure. So they've got more argument than ever before to point the finger at the European Commission and say, these guys are bureaucratic, they're slow, they are dictatorial, they have too much power over us.
When I lived in France for 3 years and moved out last November because of the pandemic, and also because, you know, with the Brexit transition and all this coming to an end, it seemed like a good time to draw that chapter to a close.
Yeah.
And, you know,
things were good,
you know. Basically, there was an element of get the fuck out, yeah. But, you know, it was a very complicated time. Anyway, but in my time in France, I saw increasingly graffiti going up around the city where I lived, Lyon. Frexit graffiti, including in the main town square, Frexit graffiti. I caught a cab one day and the driver turned around and said, I can hear you've got a British accent. I think Brexit is the best thing that's ever happened. I hope we do Frexit. Now, the idea that these kind of, as you were saying earlier, you know, there's always been anti kind of EU sentiment in and nationalist sentiment across Europe, always has. The idea that it was just the UK that thought about getting out and just the UK that was angry, it's a load of nonsense.
Just to finish off, I think, you know, we've not talked a huge amount about the WHO. I hate you. I actually hate you. What is, you and my dad would get on really well. What is what is their outlook on all of this? What do they want for this vaccine rollout globally?
So, well, right. WHO, the World Health Organization.
Yes.
Now, I have to be very clear here. I'm choosing my words carefully because I truly believe the WHO has a lot to answer for. As a personal opinion, I do not think they've come out of this well, any of this well. The role of the WHO is to try and stop this stuff happening. It's just true that their relationship with China meant that really none of us got to the bottom of what was going on in China until it was too late. That is the nature of the Chinese Communist Party and the level of trust that was put in that party and their disclosures by the WHO, because the WHO called this a pandemic when, let's face it, pretty much all of us already knew it was a pandemic. That, yes, in January they said it was a global health emergency last year that everyone should be concerned about. Fine, fair play to them. But by that point, this thing was already spreading significantly.
So they didn't move quick enough, is what you're saying.
And I don't think it's a Donald Trump thing to say that. I think the whole global view has surely got to be that the World Health Organization is going to need some form of reflection after this. It's not their fault by any means. I'm not saying it's the pandemic's not their fault, but the relationship with Beijing, you know, China is a very secretive state. The WHO has traditionally been quite delicate in that relationship because if they botch it, we lose access to China.
Don't poke the dragon.
Exactly. But by not poking the dragon, did we miss a vital chance to stop the spread of something that has now cost millions, or will eventually, sadly, it looks like cost millions of lives. So the WHO now, I believe, their view is very much to try and perhaps to take back the leadership role that maybe they felt they had lost, especially with some people like Donald Trump going on the full offensive, covering perhaps for domestic failures and domestic challenges by fully going after them. But there's always an element of truth. There's a grain of truth in everything. And the reality is the WHO certainly has been criticized around the world. It has. So now I think they're going to want to pull back into a leadership role. And they really want to see the vaccines distributed on a global basis without a vaccine war and without the rich nations hoarding them. We've already seen them calling on rich nations to do that.
They've scorned the EU, haven't they? They've said you should not be doing this, blocking vaccines from being exported.
Absolutely.
Though. Yeah.
But they're also kind of gone, looking at you at UK, looking at you America, looking at you Israel, what about the other nations? And so what do the WHO want? They want to see the vaccine program globally fairly shared. And I think by doing that, if they can be seen to have played a role in that, it might help the organization sort of scrabble back and claw back some of the credibility.
Yeah. And if you think that their goal in order to scrape back some credibility is to convince nations who are doing well on the vaccine rollout to just vaccinate the vulnerable, and then can you actually send your spare vaccines to the countries who need it? If that's their task, it's a tall task, because as we've seen and as we talked about before, the tone has been set. Most of the countries that are doing well with vaccine rollouts are not that interested in helping developing nations yet. It's a later priority.
Yeah.
So the WHO have got their work cut out for them. And just to circle back, so we're absolutely sure, is the EU still potentially going to try and block vaccines from being exported to non-EU states? Or have they backtracked on that as well?
So there are two measures. The one they've definitely enacted is called the transparency mechanism. So they want to know what's being manufactured and where. That they haven't backtracked on that. And that was then setting the stage for phase two, which is blocking the exports. That they have backtracked on. For now, through Northern Ireland. Whether, for example, they do export bans to the rest of the world, if they realise that these companies are manufacturing in the EU and exporting to, I don't know, Australia, New Zealand, somewhere else, maybe. They've left the option open to them. And at a time like this, I think it's kind of crisis after crisis for the Commission, and they're trying to keep their options open.
Yeah. So this transparency mechanism, it's such an EU, typical EU jargon. They love it.
Yeah.
It sounds lovely. Transparency mechanism. That's a great thing. But actually what it is saying we want to know where the vaccines are made. Because once we know that, we can prove that the vaccines are made in the EU, in plants like Netherlands and Belgium. And that, like you say, it's a slippery slope. Once they know where the vaccines are made, then it's the temptation for them to say, well, if they're made here, we should have dibs.
Yes. Yeah, completely. But back to hope again. Again, you know, I hope that this will resolve itself in the same way we saw the PPE row resolve itself. Once supply catches up with demand, and the demand is global, same with PPE, I believe we will start to see the tensions ease, the temperature come down, and the cooperation return. Because when you're on a plane, the pilot says, in the event of a cabin, whatever, decompression, put your own oxygen mask on first, right? And then help others. Mm-hmm. I think what you're seeing here is the EU and other countries doing that. They're trying to put their own oxygen mask on first, and once they feel they're breathing again, they'll help the person next to them.
I think that's what they're going to pitch it as. But deep down, I think those politicians are going, well, it's, you know, for example, Boris Johnson is going to be going, well, it's the UK public that are going to vote me back in. So of course I'm going to save them from this virus before I'm going to save people in a nation who haven't even heard of me, let alone have any power in voting me back into office. I think it's much more cynical than you make out, but I appreciate your optimism.
I'm trying to strike a hopeful tone for the future, for the world.
Not on this podcast.
No, this is bare naked politics. It's the truth.
Yes. Well, listen, I think we got to the bottom of that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you, Julie. Thanks for having me back.
Of course, always. You're always welcome.
Bye.
Bye. I told you that we covered a lot of bases. So that was Alex Morgan talking to me earlier today. He has a new podcast, by the way. It's called In Your Dreams. And it's where he talks to various celebrities who share their weirdest dreams. So if that sounds like your bag, and if you like talking about that sort of stuff, then I will put the details in the episode description. His first guest was Eamon Holmes, which was amazing. But just reflecting on what we said, you know, COVID is putting leaders, world leaders, in positions where they are undermining things that they've stood by for years simply to get their hands on more vaccines. Vaccines are officially gold dust. And of course, the suppliers like AstraZeneca in this sense, who make the Oxford vaccine, they're getting caught in the crossfire and they are not political bodies. So this is not their usual turf, is having to try to manage the expectations of nation states who are quarrelling with each other. That is a scary place to be caught in between, especially when your job is just to try and get as many vaccines out as possible and to not have any glitches or complications. So it is a lot for everyone to navigate. And it is a shame that something that just needs global cooperation has become political. But of course it was going to get political. You know, just making vaccines and giving them to everybody equally was never going to happen, especially when you have to buy them. So, of course, the more developed nations are going to get in there first. And of course, then those developed nations are going to argue with each other. This is a series of inevitable events. Yes, I think that'll do for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, tell me what you think, ask questions for future episodes, follow me on social media at JuliaBell_X. And if you find this podcast helpful, and if you know you're coming away from this today thinking, oh my God, I did not understand that, and now I do, please become a patron. I can't stress enough how much this podcast needs patrons in order to keep on going. So all you do is essentially buy me a coffee and it gives you exclusive access to loads of content, opinion pieces, interviews, updates, and you also, you know, get to be comfortable in the knowledge that we can carry on making these. So check that out. The link is in the episode description. And that is all. Thank you again. I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.